What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another edition of the Between the Tackles podcast. It's June. It's not June 1st, so not as many exciting headlines in the NFL as June 1st was this year, but we're back again to talk about all the things going on in the NFL. As always, give us a follow on X, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. Subscribe there at Tackles Pod. Between the Tackles on Facebook as well. We're on Spotify. We're on Apple Podcasts. Anywhere you get your podcast, you can get it courtesy of the Bleav Podcast Network. Give us a 5-star rating. Subscribe, like, comment. We'll interact with you. We love doing it. Please get at me. Call me an idiot if you need to. Like I said, I get it all the time. I'm used to it. Bring it on. I'm Burge. I'm back with my good pal, Manish Mehta. How are you doing today?
Doing great, Burge. I'm surprised that you didn't share your painstaking story about painting your shutters.
Well, let's be honest. I was hoping to move on from that. It is a two-day job in the 90-degree heat. Give me 35-degree temperatures over this 90-degree heat. Any day of the week, there you go. There's your first chance to call me an idiot right there, right? But we're not here to hear about the mundane household tasks. We're here to talk about the happenings of the National Football League, and a pretty big name got a good amount of money on a reworked contract today, and that is Patrick Mahomes, the Kansas City Chiefs. We work a contract with him through 2033, valued at over half a billion dollars, $504.75 million to be precise. It can be worth a little bit more through incentives, but I think I read somewhere, too, that this is the first time an NFL deal has been valued over half a billion dollars, which is just absolutely insane for one person for essentially 7 years, right? Essentially 7 years, he's going to make over half a billion dollars, and there's no stopping this. It's going to continue to climb. Patrick Mahomes is the first. He will not be the last to see this amount of money come his way. Manish, what do you think about this this reworked deal for Patrick Mahomes, especially coming off his ACL injury?
Thought that this was probably what both sides expected a few years ago when Mahomes signed a 10-year, $450 million deal. I remember when that happened, people thought, well, why would any player of that caliber lock himself into a 10-year deal? Because clearly the market is going to increase. And as long as he plays at a relatively high level, which at that point, you know, being in his mid to late 20s, you would have anticipated that he would. Why would he do that? I think all along, Brett Veach, the general manager of the Kansas City Chiefs, Andy Reid, and Chris Cabot, who does a terrific job with Patrick Mahomes as his agent, knew all along that at some point during this 10-year deal, they would restructure it so that his value would be more in line with what the market is telling you. And look, he was only 4 years into this 10-year deal. He had 6 years and about $265 million left in the deal. And that's about $44 million average per year, which is well below market value. This new deal, which tacks on essentially 2 years to the existing deal, puts him more in line at about $63 million a year. So much more in line with the elite quarterbacks. And clearly, Patrick Mahomes is still an elite quarterback. And ACL injury notwithstanding, I think this was the right thing to do for the Chiefs. Clearly, the right thing to do for Patrick Mahomes and Chris Cabot. And look, I give Chris Cabot, and I know him, and I've known him for a very long time, I give him a lot of credit because you really do have to put your faith in the organization when you sign a 10-year deal. Patrick Mahomes, getting $44 million a year, for me and you is great, but clearly, quote unquote, underpaid based on, his resume, his skill set, a guy who's a 3-time Super Bowl champion, 2-time NFL MVP, 5 Super Bowl appearances in his 8 seasons as a NFL starter, which is just unfathomable when you think about it. The bigger question now for the Kansas City Chiefs is, will they be able to put a team together around Patrick Mahomes? Because Travis Kelce, is clearly at the end here, probably his final season. The wide receivers that they've brought in after parting ways with Tyreek Hill just have not cut mustard, honestly. They haven't been good enough. Hollywood Brown for a little bit wasn't good enough. Juju Smith-Schuster wasn't good enough. even Xavier Worthy, frankly, came in with a lot of hype and has underwhelmed to this point in his career. They've really got to get some star power around him. Signing Kenneth Gainwell in free agency gives Patrick Mahomes another offensive weapon in the backfield, but they need to do much more if they're going to get back to the Super Bowl seemingly every other year, as they had been doing in the first 8 years of Patrick Mahomes' run as a starter. So the money is great. I think it's a fair deal for both sides. I think it's a deal, again, that I thought was probably a handshake agreement back a few years ago when they signed the original 10-year, $450 million deal. But now it's really up to Brett Veach, Andy Reid, to supplement this roster, because the roster, frankly, isn't good enough now. Regardless of how Patrick Mahomes comes back from the ACL, I think ultimately his arm's going to be fine. I think he's going to make good decisions. You wonder about his running dimension this first year back. But if they're going to be an elite team year in and year out over the next 5, 6, 7 years, they've got to bring in a better skill position talent than they have, frankly, in these past few years.
Yeah, they absolutely need to add weapons there if they're going to try to capitalize on the second half of Mahomes' career. Real quick, a little side tangent here. The way the NFL salary cap and the way the contracts work, it's something that has always started to it's really started in the last maybe 5 years. Maybe it's just because I'm getting old. I don't know. But the way that the cap structure is set up drives me bananas. All this contract restructuring and everything that goes on for these guys. I love the way the NHL does it. You sign a contract, that's your hard cap. Your card cap it for your 8 years. There's no restructuring, nothing. That's your salary, and that's what it is. This freaking deal that Myles Garrett got with the Los Angeles Rams when he restructured after the signing has 8 void years on it. 8 at the end of his career. And it's like, or the end of his contract. It's like, it's just cap manipulation. It's just salary manipulation. It's moving money around to fit guys here, fit guys there. It drives me bananas. And it, quite frankly, maybe it's because I'm getting older and I don't understand all of the nuances that go on with it. But it drives me bananas. That's all I can say on it.
It really does give the creative general managers and creative front offices an advantage. Now, some of these general managers have a scouting background, so they don't have the numbers background like Howie Roseman, for example, has, where he's doing a bulk of the work. He did a lot of great work with Jake Rosenberg, who had been their cap guy for a long time. And now there's a new set of decision makers who are supporting Howie Roseman. But the guys who have scouting backgrounds, frankly, lean on their numbers guys. And the smarter the guys you have in the front office on that end, the more creative you can be with manipulating the cap, frankly, kicking money down the road. But it's not simply kicking money down the road, but it's doing it in a way that you can keep kicking money down the road seemingly endlessly if you're smart enough and creative enough. And that's why the smartest guys in the league typically benefit the most. And, I don't want to make this to a Howie Roseman show again, but he's been one of those guys who has done exceptionally well at manipulating the cap. There's a lot of gray area. You mentioned the NHL. I'm not really familiar with the NHL, but it seems more cut and dried there. So it's maybe more of a level playing field. At least that's from the outside looking in, how it appears to me, where that's not the case in the NFL.
It's like, the only salary management or cap, however you want to call it, out of the professional sports that I will never understand at all is the NBA with the trade exemptions and everything. I will never understand that, but I love the way that the NHL does it. The NFL has all this money. They easily could institute a hard cap. Maybe the players don't want it. Maybe this benefits the owners as well. I don't know, but it's just something that over, in my 30s here, that has just absolutely drove me bananas. But the listeners out there don't want to just listen to me rant about the salary cap all episode. I could talk for an hour and a half about it. I'm not going to do that. We're going to move on to the next topic here that we want to bring up, the next headline in the NFL. Well, maybe not the NFL. This is more of a college football headline, but it's Brendan Sorsby getting reinstated by a judge after his NCAA suspension. Manish, what do you make of this?
Well, first of all, it's funny that the judge is a Lubbock judge, Lubbock, Texas, where Texas Tech is. So I'm shocked that the local judge instituted a temporary injunction against the NCAA to restore Sorsby's eligibility. Who could have ever seen that coming? I thought the 2-game suspension was a nice little touch as well. The guy bets on his own team. I know he's betting on his team to win, but he gets a 2-game suspension. Meanwhile, Pete Rose is still waiting to get in the Hall of Fame because he bet on the Reds to win when he was a manager and a player. So look, I don't want to make light of gambling. It's an addiction. It's something that, you know, people struggle with, and Sorsby has been, you know, honest and forthright, I think, in terms of trying to get help and improving. And I hope he does ultimately overcome this. But the reality is, I don't believe that he should ever compete in an NCAA game again. He bet on his team to win. And people could say, well, he's not betting on his team to lose, so he's not throwing games. What's the harm in betting on your team to win? I think there's a number of different machinations where that can be very harmful. And one that immediately jumps to mind is if the team, if Texas Tech is down by 14 points in the third quarter, and Sorsby bet on his team to win, he might feel an added sense of urgency to be a little bit more reckless, a little bit more aggressive than he would otherwise. If he weren't betting, he might be a little bit more patient and see how the remainder of the third quarter and the fourth quarter goes, and play more like a quote-unquote typical game. So there are a lot of different ways in which it is damaging, even if you are betting on your team to win. So I never, you know, subscribe to this idea that it's okay because he didn't bet on his team to lose. And I know there's a faction of people out there that think that, and I couldn't disagree more, to be honest with you. What I found fascinating is that some Big 12 teams, Georgia and Nebraska, I believe, have come out and basically said, look, we're boycotting the entire Texas Tech schedule, all sports, not just football. And now there's a lot of tough talk from Texas Tech saying that if the Big 12 tries to pull something like that off, that they will sue. And you go back and forth and back and forth. It's only because Sorsby's a good player. If Sorsby were a backup offensive lineman, Texas Tech would not go to these lengths to try to make sure that this particular player goes on the field. But this is a guy who transferred from Indiana, a guy that they believe at the most important position in the sport can help them win games and win big. So that's the reason that Texas Tech is going to all these lengths. I think from an NFL perspective, it really does change the calculus, I think, for a few teams. We'd mentioned the Cardinals and Jets as potential teams that would take a quote-unquote chance on Sorsby in the NFL supplemental draft in July. Why not? I think, you know, I think it would be smart for either team or both teams, frankly, to put in a bid for the guy. And then even some teams that have quarterbacks who are maybe a little unsure about their future at the position, like the Eagles, I think they would have been smart to look hard into drafting Sorsby in the supplemental draft. But it doesn't seem like he has any burning desire to go to the NFL right now. And it seems like he will play. I am genuinely curious if other Big 12 teams will follow the path of Georgia and Nebraska and boycott any games. That could be just a massive mess for the NCAA, for Texas Tech. And I don't think anybody truly knows how this is going to unfold over the next couple months. But from an NFL perspective, it appears that teams like the Jets and the Cardinals, who would have been very smart, I think, frankly, to draft him in the supplemental draft, it doesn't appear like they're going to have that opportunity now.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more about him not playing another NCAA game. This is, you know, you're teetering on setting a really, really bad precedent for these student athletes in the NCAA. And I agree 100% with your point about him, you know, the disagreeing with, you know, oh, he's not betting on them to lose. Again, the precedent set that you can gamble on your own team and not have to suffer basically the worst consequence, which is a ban from playing in the NCAA sports, that precedent is scary, because that I can't even think about what would come next with that. But you know, there's going to be something else that is going to come out of this should the NCAA basically be forced to let this happen. I think there's going to be a real problem. You know, you mentioned, you know, gambling and addiction and everything like that. We talk about it with the NFL players all the time about how these idiots with money can't get out of their own way, right? So
you allow something like this and you're going to have serious, serious problems down the road. So I could not agree with you more about this. And it from an NFL perspective, it's going to be very interesting to see how the college football season plays out and how this ends up impacting, you know, like you said, teams like the Jets, the Cardinals, come draft time next year when we think they're going to be in a strong market for a quarterback. So it'll be very interesting to see.
And let's not forget, in recent history, the NFL as an entity, for as embedded with gambling as they are, they've suspended players like Calvin Ridley for gambling mm-hmm. for a year, Isaiah Rodgers. And I don't even remember if Isaiah Rodgers was gambling on football, but he was gambling from the team facility, which is banned, and they were gone for a year. And now you have this player betting on his own team, suspended for two games. I'm sorry, I don't mean to make light of it, but it's so absurd that the local judge instituted this injunction because his team, Texas Tech, needs a quarterback.
Yeah, it is laughable to think about it, because you think about how close the judge is and everything around Texas Tech. It's like it stinks. It just stinks. And I hope that it gets remedied before the start of the season. Let's move it along to some more NFL news. We got the New York Giants GM Joe Shane coming out making some pretty optimistic comments about his star wide receiver Malik Nabers, Manish.
He anticipates that Malik Nabers will be ready for week one. And as recently as a week or so ago, it didn't look like Malik Nabers was really moving around particularly well at a local softball event for one of his teammates. He had the ACL injury in September early in the season. And then we found out in the offseason that he had a second procedure to clean up some scar tissue that was limiting his mobility. And John Harbaugh, I think, explicitly said this wasn't your typical ACL injury and rehab. So that raised a lot of red flags. So it's interesting that Joe Shane said that he thinks that Nabers will be ready by week one. Now, he did temper it somewhat in his comments to Yahoo Sports by saying that they do have a good complement of wide receivers. You know, as we talked about in the last episode, they signed Odell Beckham Jr., Juju Smith-Schuster, Braxton Berrios on the same day a week or so ago. Obviously, those guys are nowhere near the caliber of Malik Nabers at this stage of Nabers' career, and they've lost Wandale Robinson to free agency to the Titans. So it's going to be, a relatively barren group, to be perfectly honest, if Nabers is not ready by week one or if it takes Nabers some time to get to 100% this year.
Yeah, I agree. Their moves this offseason by bringing in a ton of guys into that wide receiver room leads me to think that Joe Shane is a little too optimistic at this point. But ACL injuries are not what they used to be, right? They're not what they used to be. And you've seen receivers and running backs come back quicker than, you know, we were originally accustomed to. You know, you hear ACL, you instantly think full year, right? You instantly think full year going back at the technology and the surgeries and everything has stepped up or stepped down that timeline, I should say, to, you know, make it a little bit quicker. I'd be curious if he is ready for week one, what version of Malik Nabers are we going to get? I mean, a ACL for a wide receiver is a significant injury. I mean, for a guy that, you know, builds his game on quickness and shifting and cutting, how is he going to look? I mean, if he's ready for week one, you know he's not going to be 100%. Like, it's not going to be 100%. And, you know, it comes to the Giants brass at this point. Like, do they want to rush him back for week one? Like, do they want to, if it was me, my personal opinion, if, like, he's not 100% week one, why rush him back? A player that young, you know, you rush him back too early, that could have career impact, you know, career, you know, consequences. Right. You know, in terms of the healing, like, it will he ever get back to that point that he was at if he doesn't come back, if he comes back too soon? So that would be something that I'd want to monitor, especially given the fact that they, you know, we laugh about Odell Beckham and Juju Smith-Schuster and Braxton Berrios, but they have guys in the building now that can step in and kind of, you know, bide the time for Malik to get back. Now, like, I agree with you 100% that these guys coming in are not anywhere close to what Malik Nabers was before he got hurt. But if these guys are able to afford the Giants the ability to be a little bit more patient with Malik Nabers coming back and really take care of that knee going into the season, I think that could be a really, really good thing for the Giants to do. So we'll see where that goes from there. I want to move on to, you know, we'll call them my second favorite NFL team, because I love to hate them. And it's some comments from the Buffalo Bills star quarterback, Josh Allen. And Manish, you and I talked a little bit about this in the text chain. It was kind of a comical comment that Josh Allen made.
Yes, I can't believe that you referred to him as a star. So that's the first step in admitting that he is actually a great player.
Hey, 12 steps. That's the first one.
Josh Allen had a long-ranging interview with Tyler Dunn on Tyler's Substack, Going Long. And one of the gems out of that interview was that Allen said that the Buffalo Bills winning a Super Bowl would be the last greatest story told in the NFL or something to that effect, which is kind of cute. Look, I'm a Josh Allen fan. You know that. I couldn't disagree more with that sentiment. This is a team that once upon a time went to 4 consecutive Super Bowls. So they've had some measure of success, over the last, whatever it was, 20, 25 years. I think the greatest football story that hasn't been told, that is still dangling and probably not going to be told for a while, is the Cleveland Browns. This is a franchise I believe entered the NFL in 1950. They have had 4 football titles pre-Super Bowl. The last one was in 1964. But if ever there was a star-crossed franchise with more heartache than the Cleveland Browns, and that includes the Buffalo Bills, I don't see it. I mean, this is a team, if you're old enough to remember, in 1980, Red Right, 88, every NFL fan who's my age or older knows what that is. It's a mistake by the late Brian Sipe with an interception that cost them a trip to the Super Bowl, and then perhaps the 2 most crushing defeats, back-to-back AFC championship games in the 86 and 87 seasons with John Elway's 98-yard touchdown drive, just an unbelievable, masterful drive by John Elway, and then Ernest Biner fumbling as he's going into the end zone to take the lead. I mean, I remember watching that as a kid, and I felt truly sad for Browns, fans, their teams. There's a reason why the nickname of the franchise, the unofficial nickname, I should say, is Factory of Sadness. It is just a really brutal history for this franchise, especially in the Super Bowl era. They haven't had a Super Bowl appearance. Those are their 3 closest chances in the 80s. I think if they somehow won a Super Bowl, and again, I don't see it happening anytime soon because they don't have a quarterback, but if that ever happened, that'd be an unbelievable story. Not to mention the Detroit Lions. They're also a team that's actually been a part of the NFL longer. I think they were have been a member of the NFL since 1930, and they haven't gotten to a Super Bowl. And they've had some great teams these last few years, and they haven't been able to get there. Those 2 franchises stick out to me, with all apologies to Buffalo Bills fans and Bills Mafia. That would be just a better story as someone who doesn't root for any of those teams.
You don't have to apologize to them, first of all. We don't have to apologize to Bills Mafia, all right? No, I agree with you. I agree with you. I will give him a little bit of a break here because it would be a great NFL story.
Sure.
Not for me. It'd be a terrible story for me.
No, it's a great story. It's not the greatest, but it would be a great story for everyone except Bills. Except you and Patriots fans.
But you think that they've arguably been one of the most successful teams of this decade, right? You know, they've won the most. They've had a lot of crushing defeats in the playoffs. So it would be a decent story. But I totally agree. Cleveland Browns. I mean, you know, I was just thinking about this because I think when we were talking, I was like Detroit. It would be Detroit for me. One, and then a distant for Cleveland second. But I was just thinking, you know, we talked about, you know, the 80s with John Elway and the losses there. You got to remember, this isn't even the original Cleveland Browns franchise, right? They lost their team. Art Modell moved the team to Baltimore, and they came back as an expansion team. So in terms of the city of Cleveland, I don't think anything would top this. I mean, I would love to be a fly on in the sky watching the city of Cleveland the night that they end up finally winning a Super Bowl, because that city is going to go off, right? They're going to party. They're going to go crazy. I mean, wasn't it not too long ago they had the Bud Light thing in the bars there where they got free Bud Light if the Browns won or something like that?
Yeah, I was at that game. It was a Baker Mayfield game on a a primetime game. I don't remember if it was a Thursday night or a Sunday night, but they beat the Jets.
And they won. Yeah. And they all got free beer. so the story would be incredible there. I mean, you know, you disagreed with me on this, but I think Jerry Jones getting one more before he kicks the can would be a great story. Again, it doesn't rise to the level of Cleveland, but I'd argue it would rival the Buffalo Bills story. I mean, you could feel bad for Bills fans all they want. They had 4 years in a row where they had a shot to do it and they didn't do it. And, you know, they have arguably one of the most crushing Super Bowl losses with the wide right game. But still, yeah, I can't buy into that being the last greatest NFL story. Like, no. Cleveland and Detroit are far and away one and two on that list. Might even 1A, 1B for me. But let's move on to another AFC East team, the more fun AFC East team. And this kind of ties into your NFC East team, too, but it's about A.J. Brown, who's now a member of my Patriots. And very happy to have him here. But he made some interesting comments, didn't he, Manish?
Well, I think this is a two-parter. One, in his interview with Maria Taylor, he said that he talked to the media and he wanted to kind of motivate some of his teammates by some of the things he said. And these are in post-game scrums by his locker. I remember after one of the early season struggles, somebody had asked, what's the biggest issue with the offense? And his answer was passing. And everybody obviously took that as a shot at Jalen Hurts. And that is what A.J. Brown was referring to in this most recent interview. Somehow on social media, I can't believe people misconstrued or didn't have the reading comprehension skills to understand what A.J. Brown was saying. Somehow this whisper down the lane treatment turned into A.J. Brown was leaking information as an unnamed source to reporters and bashing Jalen Hurts and his teammates, which is not what he said. He clearly did not say that, yet some people in some reputable places, frankly, aggregated that and wrote about it. And I'm glad that, you know, some people pushed back on that in the media. The other funny element of the A.J. Brown Eagles divorce was that he went back, I believe it was last week, maybe the week before, to collect his stuff. And he was at the Eagles facility. And according to Mike Garofalo of NFL Network, ESPN, there's a wall of Pro Bowl players in Eagles history, pictures. And he signed his picture. But instead of just having the signature, he also wrote, "The best to ever play here, always open." And always open is kind of his moniker. Mm-hmm. You know, he wanted Eagles fans to chant AO every time he caught a pass. And I think that didn't gain a lot of traction, but some fans at Lincoln Financial Field did do that. What jumped out to me was the sheer arrogance of writing "the best to ever play here." And I am the biggest A.J. Brown fan that I know. I mean, that might be supplanted by you now because he's on your team, but I'm a big A.J. Brown fan. But I will say with 100% confidence, he is not the best wide receiver in the history of the Philadelphia Eagles. That goes to Harold Carmichael, who's their all-time receptions leader, one of the best players in the history of the franchise, regardless of position. I would even say DeSean Jackson was a better wide receiver as an Eagle than the four-year run that A.J. Brown has. And then if you're really a diehard Eagles fan, you remember Tommy McDonald, who played in the late 50s and early 60s. He had a better four-year run back then when they were playing 12 and 14 games. He had a better four-year run than A.J. Brown. He had four consecutive double-digit touchdown seasons, 46 touchdowns in 52 games in a four-year span. A.J. Brown played 61 games, nine more games than McDonald, and he scored 14 fewer touchdowns, 32. So with all due respect to A.J. Brown, he's not the best wide receiver in Eagles history. He's not one of the top three wide receivers in Eagles history. He is an incredible player who had a magical two-year run, back-to-back 1,400-yard seasons. And I appreciate the confidence and the self-belief, but I'm not sure that was the wisest thing to do, to kind of scribble that after you essentially orchestrated your way out to the team that you wanted to go to all along.
I love that arrogance. I love that confidence. I love that arrogance. Like, it's hard for me to think back with the Patriots where they've had a guy with that attitude, right? That had that attitude. I mean, you could talk about Gronk. You could, Edelman never had that attitude. You know, none of those guys had that attitude. So, like,
I mean, I can think of one guy.
Am I drawing a blank on it?
I think you're forgetting arguably the second best wide receiver in the history of pro football.
Talking about Moss?
Randy Moss. He absolutely had that attitude.
When he was with the Patriots, though?
Randy Moss was as confident and arrogant as you can get in a great way. He quit on the Raiders. He quit on the Raiders, much like some people believe A.J. Brown quit on the Eagles. And it wasn't because his skills were diminishing, because he went to get out of there. I can't even remember the name of the quarterback in his final season with the Raiders. He had one really good season with the Raiders, actually. But at the end, it was brutal. And he quit on him. And I don't know if you remember. You probably do because you're a diehard fan. He did not play in the preseason in the run-up to his first season with the Patriots. He had a hamstring injury. People thought he was dogging it again, that he was old, he was too old. First week of the season at the Meadowlands, he
torched
the Jets for over 100 yards. I believe he had 3 touchdowns. I'll never forget it because after the game, I came up to the Jets safety, a free safety, Kerry Rhodes, and said, well, what'd you think about Randy Moss? People thought he was done. He really didn't partake in the offseason at all. And I remember Kerry looked me straight in the face and said, well, evidently he was fresh. And he absolutely was. And that led to an historic season for Randy Moss.
Well, if a wide receiver orchestrating their way out when people think, you know, he's declining. I've heard that quite a bit from you. Orchestrate his way to New England. Maybe something's cooking here. That's just me being optimistic. I don't think that type of season is going to actually happen. So I'm not that stupid. I'm not that big of a homer. So let's calm down there. But yeah, I love hearing that type of arrogance. And you got any more you want to talk about AJ Brown before we move on to the final topic of the pod?
I think he's going to have a great season. He's obviously not at the caliber of Randy Moss, but I think he's going to have a great season with Drake May. I think Drake May is a better quarterback than Jalen Hurts. And even though A.J. Brown isn't 25 or 26, I wouldn't expect a 1,400-yard season. I would anticipate, you know, 1,200 yards if he plays a full season, maybe, you know, pushing it above that. I think where you're going to see the big difference with A.J. Brown in New England is that you're going to see a lot of red zone activity. I think you're going to see double-digit touchdowns. I don't believe he did that in Philadelphia. I think you're going to see that this year. He will be highly motivated in his first season with New England. You know, how long that goes beyond 2026 remains to be seen. But I would be stunned, frankly, if A.J. Brown were healthy, if he did not have a dominant season.
To hear that. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. Can't wait. Is it July yet? Is it July training camp? No, it's not. Let's close out the pod with the story of the offseason. And that's bringing up this thing. I hate doing it, but Manish, you put it on the notes, so I have to do it. I don't like it, but we're going to talk about the Vrabel-Rossini drama. You know, the athletic internal investigation on Rossini is still a long way away. It doesn't sound like it's going to be wrapping up anytime soon. Is Mike Vrabel in the clear? Those were the notes you sent me here. I've been saying this for a month, and I feel vindicated reading this on what you wanted to talk about in this episode here, but I feel vindicated.
I think that he's in the clear, barring something really outrageous from this investigation and or Rossini actually speaking to somebody at some point on the record, which something that she has not done. The Athletic did come out and say during an internal meeting that they're a few weeks away. So unfortunately for the Patriots, this investigation is going to come to light before training camp. And then in the first, you know, depending on what's in it, in the first day or so, or even longer, depending again on what the investigation reveals, that'll be another topic of conversation. But I ultimately think that Mike Vrabel is, quote unquote, in the clear, as long as Dione Rossini does not go on the record. And whether she goes on the record or not is something that none of us knows. There's been speculation that maybe there'll be an NDA in an agreement where Rossini is financially compensated by Mike Vrabel to keep things quiet. I don't know if that's been a discussion point or not, but if that were to happen, then obviously from Mike Vrabel's professional standpoint, this would go away. Otherwise, it's really in Rossini's court. What she would say, when she would say it, and how that would impact how the Patriots feel about Mike Vrabel is something that none of us really knows, because I don't think any of us, including the Krafts, truly know the details of what happened between those two, other than, you know, those two and perhaps, you know, their spouses.
Frankly, I don't think anything is going to change how the Krafts view Mike Vrabel unless something comes out that he hurt the brand in a way that causes discipline from the NFL. And I'm talking tampering and, you know, the whole thing with AJ Brown. If there was actually something that came out from that where now you're impacting the Krafts business in terms of the league and everything like that, that's the only way I could see the Patriots and Krafts making a difference at this point. Like, if something comes out more about the relationship between them, the two of them, you know, from a personal level, right? From a personal level, that's not going to do anything to change the Patriots at this. That would have already happened if that was going to be the case. It's going to have to be something NFL, league, football related that comes out. That's going to have to, you know, that would cause them to really rethink things, right? So I feel vindicated. I feel vindicated because you said he's in the clear, and it took me so long to hear that. And now, I'm opening my mouth now. Am I going to get slapped in the face and karma in a month? It very well could happen, and I'll be sitting here with my tail between my legs, with my head down, right? Something comes out from this internal investigation that maybe Vrabel's not in the clear. I'm gonna end up looking like with my head down. You're not gonna hear me. You're just gonna see my head, my hat, and I'm just gonna be shaking my head while you're gloating about it on that end.
Well, so, I won't be gloating. What I will say is that in all likelihood, he probably is in the clear. But then the noise will ratchet up when they start off 0-4, and we can talk about that after their the 0 for September.
Oh, you gotta try to throw a dig in there. Ooh, that's a good. That's a good way to close it up.
Plenty of time to talk about Mike Vrabel and the overrated New England Patriots as the season gets closer. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to hit the subscribe button, leave a 5-star rating, write a review. You can find us Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. Comment. You can find us on all the other social platforms, TikTok, Instagram, at TacklesPod. Again, your comment and feedback really go a long way to helping us evolve and grow and give you the content that you would like. And that'll do it for this episode. For Burge, I'm Manish. We will see you next time.